All this week, we're talking about privatization in America, and today we're taking a look at the privatization of public space and how it's changing our cities. Gerald Caden is a professor of urban planning and design at Harvard University. He joins me now. Welcome.
Thank you.
So you wrote the book on privately owned public spaces, which actually has a specific meaning in urban planning circles. Tell us what that means, privately owned public space.
Privately owned public spaces are small plazas, arcades, and other outdoor and indoor spaces that are provided in an unusual way. Developers of office and residential towers are allowed to build bigger buildings if they agree in return to provide these privately owned public spaces, normally in front of their buildings or inside on the first floor.
Are they taking away space that was public space before? Is that why they have to make this deal?
It's entirely on private property. They are not taking away anything. They're getting something that is financially valuable to them, and in return, they're providing something of value to society as a whole.
And is this a new idea?
It's not a new idea. It started in New York City in 1961, although people in Chicago argue, no, our city did it first several years earlier. But it really started in New York City, plazas and arcades, 1961, and now there are over 540 of these privately owned public spaces in New York, and it's spread around the world, San Francisco, Vancouver, Toronto, Seoul, South Korea, Tokyo, Japan, and many other cities around the world.
And what was the reason for it?
The reason was this notion of almost a free lunch. Cities and their budgets are and were increasingly squeezed, and this would be a good way to get public space for free without the city allocating any of its land or any of its money. Let's have the private sector provide all of these wonderful spaces. And also, they were smaller spaces scattered about. An archipelago in a city as opposed to Central Park. In New York City, for example, if you aggregated all of these privately owned public spaces together, they would cover 10% of Central Park, but they're scattered throughout the city.
Hmm. But there's no such thing as a free public space, I guess, to change a well-known saying. What's the downside of this?
The downside is that you have the fox guarding the hen house. So the developers and owners of these buildings provided these spaces not necessarily and really not because they loved public space and wanted to serve the public. They wanted these zoning concessions that delivered financial value to them. So when the public started to use these spaces, these owners said, well, we don't really want the public on these spaces. And too often they privatized these public spaces. And they did it through denial of access. So they would say, sorry, this isn't a public space. Or they'd keep it closed when it was supposed to be open. Or they'd allow adjacent private uses to annex the public space, what I sometimes call cafe creep or brasserie bulge or trotteria trickle.
Hmm.
And I'm not against cafes, but it makes people have to pay to enjoy public space, which violates one of the central tenets of public space.
This also came up in the Occupy Wall Street protests in New York because Zuccotti Park in New York is one of these privately owned public spaces, right?
Yes. This is actually a very interesting example that demonstrates that the identity of the owner being either government or private doesn't always determine the publicness of the space. So yes, Zuccotti Park, occupied by Occupy Wall Street, was indeed one of these privately owned public spaces. In other words, it was privately owned. And yet the requirements on the owner were to keep the space open 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Several blocks to the north, City Hall Park, immediately below City Hall, actually shuts down every evening from dusk to dawn. So in fact, Occupy Wall Street was very smart to occupy a privately owned public space rather than a publicly owned city park.
What about parks aside? Another example of this is malls. In a lot of cities, the mall is the central place in the city where you can go and shop or walk around and hang out, whatever. But it also is private.
For many years, urban planners and real estate people have observed that malls replaced the main street.
Right.
Now, the main street had a publicly owned street, a publicly owned sidewalk, and now that was being replaced by a shopping mall, which was completely privately owned and completely privately controlled. And in the main, that's true. Now, if you're going to have commercial activities, you have to allow some degree of publicness, but they still feel private. Under the California Constitution, individuals have a right to free speech in malls, assuming the malls are public. That's quite interesting as an intrusion on private property, and yet it's guaranteed by the California Constitution.
So what's the effect of all of this, the privatization of these public spaces in America?
The privatization of the public realm, I think, at the end of the day, results potentially in a feeling that we're not really all in this together, that there's not a level playing field. There are areas for wealthier people, and then there are areas for poorer people. I mean, the signature element of public space is that it is open to all, regardless of income, regardless of status, with a relative lack of interference, a sense of possibility, a sense of freedom. Even disagreements are all right, because that's the nature of society that goes beyond family or company, that everybody is involved. That gets harmed or reduced when people no longer feel that public spaces are truly public.
Is there any move afoot to move us back in the other direction?
Right now, I think the answer is no. I think the decision has been made by governments and by people that the tension between providing privately provided public space is simply the answer to shrinking public budgets. When you have public spending on parks reducing year to year to year at local, state, and national levels, then the question is, how do we get these public spaces? And the answer seems to be, in part, at least with regard to parks, that we empower local groups, friends of, state groups, national groups, conservancies, to raise money from private donors to pay for public space. That's a great thing in many ways. And the public spaces may, in fact, to some degree, look better, operate better. But at the same time, there's a feeling of loss of public control, a ceding of control to these private donors who understandably want some degree of control in return for their contribution.
That's Gerald Caden, who's a professor of urban planning and design at Harvard University. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
And it's not just parks and city streets, but also roads and bridges that are getting more private through public-private partnerships. Joining us now is Eduardo Engel, professor of economics at the University of Chile. He studies the issue around the world. And professor, in general, are we seeing more privately owned or operated infrastructure in the U.S.?
We are seeing an increase, but more importantly, we're seeing the possibility of a huge increase over the coming years based on one of the campaign promises of President Trump, which is to spend $1 trillion on new infrastructure and revamping existing infrastructure.
What do we already have in this country when it comes to privatized public space or infrastructure?
There's a significant amount of private participation, but there are in some sectors, and let's talk to be specific, say, about transportation, states that go into debt to finance new roads, to finance new highways. The amount of public-private partnerships has been growing over the last 10, 20 years, but the initial base is very small, so that even though growth has been fast, still as a fraction of the total, it's a small number.
So give me an example.
So there's two major highways in the U.S. in the 1990s, the Dulles Greenway near Washington, D.C., and Orange County SR-91 near Orange County and close to L.A., which were two public-private partnerships. In one case, it was a lane of approximately 10 miles. Another case was a tolled lane besides two untolled lanes near California, Orange County.
And is there a problem with that?
Well, if you look at the worldwide experience, and it's also been in the U.S., these are long-term contracts. Basically, a private firm builds a road, finances, and then has 20, 30, 40 years, sometimes even more than that, to recuperate its investment by charging user fees, by charging tolls, and sometimes also by receiving some subsidies from government. And in this long period, there's a lot of opportunity for renegotiating the original contract. When you have the traditional approach, you come, you build, and then you leave. And so there's little opportunity for renegotiations of contracts. But the big downside with public-private partnerships has been a lot of renegotiations, often to the detriment of taxpayers, to the detriment of users who end up paying more. But that has been the downside with public-private partnerships, and is the one reason why you should be careful about how you do it.
And I guess the upside would be you don't have to spend as much taxpayer money.
Well, that's what everyone believes, but it's not correct because it's true. You don't spend money at the beginning because you don't build it, but then you give up the chance of charging tolls, which you would have done otherwise. You take those two and it cancels out unless under a public-private partnership you're more efficient. But what you can get is much better maintenance. And if you look at maintenance of U.S. infrastructure, in particular transportation infrastructure, it's not great, and that happens in many, many countries. The politics of maintenance is not good. It's much more attractive for a politician to inaugurate a new highway, a new infrastructure project, than to maintain properly an existing project, which is not the case under a public-private partnership. In those cases, if you write the correct contract, there are very strong incentives to maintain correctly, and also evidence shows that maintenance is much better.
That's Eduardo Engel, a professor of economics at the University of Chile in Santiago. He's the co-author of a new book called The Economics of Public-Private Partnerships. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Jeremy.